Good afternoon. Welcome to Access Advocacy. We're coming to you on thepowerofvoices.com. You can find us at accessadvocacy.org. I'm Nancy Renee, and with me is our co-founder,
Adrian Shapiro.
Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Nancy.
You know, we were talking the other day, Adrian and I, and we talked about all of the various shows that we've done, and we've done really quite a few. And Adrian had a great idea. Adrian, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I said, we've been at this a year, and we've had so many wonderful guests. Let's just do a show talking about our favorite shows.
You know, and I just thought that was super. Because I'll tell you, when we started, my only experience was knowing the people with sickle cell disease that I know and hearing basically stories of rude, disrespectful behavior from our local hospitals, and that was it. That was all I knew. But Adrian, you opened me up to a whole other area.
A whole another area?
Yeah.
I guess so, huh? Yeah. Well, there's science behind it. There's, I think for me, that was it more than anything, driving. Was that the thought that soon we would have a cure and our better treatments, and getting to talk to people about the work that's being done was really enticing for me.
It was for me too. And people were interested and enthusiastic about being on the show with us. And Adrian's exactly right. We had people from government agencies. I mean, we had Dr. Houlihan from the CDC, you know, and I never thought, well, the CDC would be interested and willing in talking with us. We had Dr. Alexis Thompson, who is now the president of ASH, and ASH is the American Society of Hematology, and she came on. We've had people, of course, our friend Kevin from CIRM.
That's right, Kevin. Shout out to Kevin.
Yeah. Who was always, just always helpful. And then you mentioned some of the doctors that...
Absolutely. We had Dr. Nahara.
Absolutely.
We had Dr. Ted Love, but he just goes by Ted Love now from GBT.
Yes.
We had, let's see. Oh, remember the guy? It was a PhD who talked to us about viruses.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no, that's not our show. That was actually Josefa's show.
Okay. Well, we've got so many things going on. I remember Mass Therapeutics, and they were in the middle of a trial that didn't work. And really, it just shows you, I admire everybody in the research field because they have spent years and years and thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to make something work, and it seems like it's just about to work, and then somehow they don't meet their endpoints. And, you know, endpoints are what happens when you design a study, and this is what you expect to happen, and when what you expect to happen doesn't happen. That's really difficult, and it makes it that much more difficult for the company to get involved in research again because they've lost money on something. And yet it seems like companies just kind of dig back in and start up again. So,
well, it's good that you mention that because I always say that we learn from our mistakes.
Right.
And one of the things I learned was why it's so important to have patients involved when you are identifying endpoints. I also learned how important it was for us in our community to have a discussion about pain and what types of pain we're experiencing when we have sickle cell. So many times people think basically of the blockage in the capillaries, of that being the only pain, when it turns out we have neurological pain, we have pain brought on by opioids, we have inflammation pain just like anybody else. And that conversation with Greg about their endpoints and their studies made me really, really think and start to change the dialogue I had with the patients we were advocating for so that they could speak about their pain, as well as having discussions with other researchers on when they're writing their endpoints to be very, very aware of endpoints, and particularly if they were discussing pain, to put in some qualifiers when they talked about whatever treatment they were working on curtailing sickle cell pain.
Yep. No, I think that's critically important. And Adrian, I know you have some personal experience with this, and that's the pain of inflammation. What happens when you have sickle cell disease, but now your major problem is that you've got a bad infection.
Right,
and it's just going through your body, and it's just wiping you out.
Well, I had an interesting trip. I was on at one of the conferences, I think it was PCORI, with one of the sickle cell warriors. And, you know, as the mom, I'm always the mom. I can't turn it off. So we were sitting at the table together, and I said, "You don't look well." And she looked at me, and she said, "No, you know, I'm really not feeling well. I'm really just kind of achy." And she had done all the things she was supposed to do. She had liquids. I made sure she had a blanket.
Yes.
And I said, "Well, does it feel like crisis pain?" And she sat there for a moment, you know, with these big, beautiful eyes looking at me. And finally she said, no, you know what? This doesn't feel like crisis pain. I said, "Well, what kind of pain does it feel like?" She says, "Well, it's just like all achy." I said, "You've got fever?" And I did the mom thing, you know, forehead to forehead. And she had a fever. And we both looked at each other and said, "Oh, could it be the flu?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out, yes, it was the flu. And how do I know that? Because 3 days later, I came down with the flu. Even though I'd had my flu shot, the doc said, "Nope, it's the flu." So that's just interesting how this journey has changed us in the last year, hasn't it?
Yes. Well, back to the people that we had on the show, with the idea being to think about what our most favorite show was. So we've talked a little bit about some of our doctors. And again, I'm so grateful and thankful to them for agreeing to be part of the show, to doing the preparation that you need in order to explain things clearly. And it's not easy in this kind of format when you're talking about very technical medical terminology. But another group of people that we had were people in support areas, and I really like them as well. We had, of course, Pat Corley, who is our senior, I'll call her our senior sickle cell nurse specialist.
Absolutely.
I mean, she has guided a number of people with sickle cell disease through really every aspect of treatment. She has been a mainstay at County USC. But it came out just great, and it really gave us some insight as to what her role was and what it takes to be a nurse coordinator of an effective sickle cell program. And she's done that for years, and yes, she's been recognized, but I'm going to recognize her again because she's been irreplaceable in the sickle cell community.
Absolutely. She's known as the sickle cell nurse by not only the patients, but actually we were at Cal State Fresno, and one of the docs came walking down the hallway, and she, of course, was completely out of context because here she was in Fresno and not at USC where he met her. He runs over. He's like, "Nurse Pat," and he immediately starts to tell her all the things he'd been doing and thanking her for what he, you know, she taught him about sickle cell and letting us know that sickle cell was something that he was going to be working in, you know, now that he had finished school. And she just has that effect everywhere we go.
Yes. Pat Corley seems to put all of that together.
I think, too, and graciously, I have to add. I mean, as we know, we're not always treated the way we should be treated or how we feel we should be treated. And one of the things she says is the sickle cell nurse is many times the most hated nurse in the hospital.
Yes, she says that.
Because they fight so hard and have to fight so hard, but she seems to fight graciously for us and continues to.
And Adrian, as you know better than I do, when you don't have a Pat Corley, then that leaves the parent and the patient advocate leading that fight, leading that charge, kind of against the rest of the whole hospital system, the nurses, the doctors, the hospital administration, who at their best seem only to want to placate us so that maybe we'll stop asking them for more stuff and just kind of go and quietly sit with the patient and not expect too much. But we don't operate that way. Adrian doesn't operate that way because we can't. The lives of our patients and our family are at stake, and so we can't just sit back and let it go. Some other people that are in that nurse and nurse coordinator position are the ladies we met at Children's Hospital.
Yes, Kelly and team.
Kelly and Annie Nord and Dawn Canada.
Yes.
Really outstanding women that looked and saw a need for what they developed as the Passages Program, so that those young people who were approaching adulthood, 17, 18 years old, that they had a passage to take them into effective adult care. And they put this together themselves. And I think it's very effective. I think that it's one of those statistics that we have to look at and shake our heads. Why are our kids dying in their 20s? What's going on? They're still young. Well, what's happening is that there are not enough adult doctors to treat young adults with sickle cell disease, and so they kind of fall through the cracks. So these women are really working hard at Children's Hospital to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Absolutely. I mean, truly, you know, hearts and minds.
Yes. Well, Adrian, have you thought of any particular shows that are your favorites?
Well, they're all so different. I'm thinking of sometimes how we kind of corral people.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure how they were going to accept us. But we just finished doing the HD Care Symposium at UC Irvine, and it was pretty funny. They had a speaker. She was from a pharmaceutical company, and of course, when she got done, I pounced on her because the model they were using for setting up their trials was very, very exciting to me, and I wanted to talk to her about the idea of including a patient advocate on their clinical trials teams, and she started answering my questions. And then I said, oh, and popped out my handy microphone, which, of course, then her cheeks went, like, completely blushed. And she was like, I don't know if I can talk to you. Well, it's very interesting because the doctor who was sitting next to her said, oh, I'll talk to you. We had the most wonderful conversation. So I think back, that being our, you know, my second conversation with the HD team, and how initially talking about sickle cell, that they were so open and willing to share the knowledge that they had learned about Huntington's and how, in fact, what they had learned, how that could be applied to some of the same health problems we were facing with sickle cell.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that that was kind of fun because I caught everybody off guard. Nobody came there that morning thinking they were going to end up recording a radio show.
Right. And we were just talking before we started recording with our engineer, Lee Michaels. Thank you, Lee, for all of the hard work that you do putting the show together. But giving us some suggestions as to how we can use our phones, how we can use lapel mics so that the sound is decent as we are recording people. because there's just so much stuff out there. I didn't realize it. Adrian, maybe you did, but oh my goodness, all of the universities, all of the various organizations that are putting on conferences, lectures, summits, whether it's about sickle cell or it's about chronic disease or it's about mental health issues connected to chronic disease, all of these things are connected in some way to the issues that we face in the sickle cell community. And so we're going to be kind of waylaying people in the near future, because I think it will be very interesting for the our listening audience. And we recognize that people are listening to us from all over the United States. So although, you know, we're based in California and we talk about some of the things we do here, UC Irvine, Fresno, which is kind of in the middle of the state. We're based in Los Angeles, the things that are happening in Northern California and so forth. We hope that our issues apply to people in other states and in other countries. And we know that there is a lot of stuff going on in France, some research. We know there's a lot of stuff going on in Great Britain. So we're just happy to be able to have this kind of a reach so that people can maybe listen to what some of our speakers have said and then go and find their own researchers, their own doctors, their own nurses and social workers, and find out what's going on in your home country. So are we thinking about naming the favorite show yet, or you have to think about it some
yeah.
more?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's kind of hard. You mentioned your favorite show, so we're going to let you go with your favorite show now.
Well, after thinking about, again, all of the researchers, for me, the favorite shows were Members of the Community, and in this case, it was the Father's Day show. And we interviewed two fathers that we know really pretty well because they're our own family members. But so often we moms and grandmothers get all involved because a lot of this is part of our role, you know, taking care of people, advocating for them, bringing them blankets and so forth, that sometimes we almost push the guys away. The men are left following behind, wondering, you know, well, what is my place? But we interviewed our producing engineer, Ron Shapiro, and my partner in crime, Cecil McLinn. Ron is, as you may know, the stepfather of Marissa, who we hear about quite often. I have mentioned Cecil's daughter, Tiffany. Both of these young women are middle-aged now. And so their issues are a little bit different from what fathers of young kids would face. But what they had to say really helped me to see how challenging it is when you are with your adult daughter in the emergency room, in the intensive care unit, trying to get the best care for them. And so we're going to edit in a little bit of that conversation that they had prior to Father's Day last year.
Well, after college, my daughter decided to go to New York. She was an English major and study theater in New York. And so that was another thing. Oh my God, she's gone all the way across the country. What in the world is going to happen? She indicated to me that when she went to New York, she was there for about 3 or 4 years. She was okay. Her sickle cell episodes were rare. She was busy working in theater, and then she started working in film. And as far as I can remember, she was okay. She didn't have a lot of issues. At least I wasn't aware of them. However, when she came back to California, she got married and went into the film industry, did very well. And as far as I know, she didn't have any real serious episodes at that time. However, after her divorce, it was a different ball game because that was very stressful for her. And I recall that she started to have more episodes with pain, and she discussed it a lot with us, and she began to have a few visits to a neighboring hospital in the West LA area, and started some treatment there, and she was okay for several years, and then she started going into the hospital because her career, I guess as getting older and pain becoming more severe with various issues, she began to now start visiting the ER and in the hospitals.
Right. And brag a little bit about your daughter. Tell us a little bit about some of the films that she worked on.
Well, my daughter had the privilege of working on several of Spike Lee's films while she was in New York. She did work on Malcolm X. She did work on, I think She's Gotta Have It. I can't think of that. And I think it was also Mo Better Blues. She also worked in theater, live theater, and met a lot of actors that are her close friends today. Lawrence Fishburne, Samuel L. Jackson, other people that are close friends of hers. So she had a great career in New York. When she came out here to California, she worked with Eddie Murphy at Paramount Pictures. So she did that for many years.
You know, I asked you, I had an ulterior motive in asking you that, because sometimes our families wonder what's going to happen with their youngsters. Are they going to be able to have a successful career? Are they going to be able to lead fulfilling lives? And certainly for a number of years, Tiffany was really at the top. She was at the top. Unfortunately, her disease began to, as you said, it began to raise its ugly head. And I would say when she was about 40, because that's when she was, not only was she being hospitalized, but she was not getting good treatment from two of our local, very well-known hospitals. We won't mention their names, but these are hospitals that make the top lists of hospitals that come out. But for a patient with sickle cell, you have to be very careful. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, when I became involved, particularly when she was single again, the first major hospital she called me to come into was treating her as though she was drug-seeking. We had to wait for long periods of time in the ER. We were getting very frustrated, and I'm talking sometimes four to 6 hours, and we were determining whether she should be admitted or not, and I was going back and forth with the ER doctors. And it was a struggle, and it was very frustrating because at some points they would say, well, okay, your daughter should be admitted to the hospital next door. And I said, okay, let's do it. I could see her in great pain. And one of the things that I began to learn is when the ER doctors would ask her, what's your pain level from 1 to 10? She was 10, 10 and a half, and they would look at her like, what is that? And it was a struggle for us to begin to have the doctors understand what kinds of medications that she had. So that was the beginning of the big battle we were going to have for several years with our hospitals and her treatment.
It sounds like at this top well-known hospital, that's also a teaching hospital, I'll say that much about it, but it doesn't seem like much teaching about sickle cell is going on. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. I would agree. More than 100%. I was amazed at the fact that their lack of knowledge in the history of many adult sickle cell patients, where it's common for hips to disintegrate, and what do you do about it? But yes, I would agree with you. The lack of knowledge of sickle cell patients with these kinds of disorders is amazing, that lack of. Slowly, NIH guidelines, you know, it's still a problem.
This is Axis Advocacy, AXIS Advocacy, on thepowerofvoices.com. For our Father's Day show, we're speaking with our second father, Ron Shapiro.
Hello.
Hi, Ron. Ron, your situation is a little bit different than Cecil's, but probably not that different from many of the fathers that are listening to this podcast right now. Tell us your story.
Well, I married into a family where sickle cell is present. Our older daughter has sickle cell, and to be honest, I didn't really know a lot. I knew probably as much as some of these ER doctors, to be honest, after I've talked to them. It's just enough to know that it's a blood disorder and it hurts.
But tell us a little bit about the frustrations you might have had as the stepfather of a daughter, an adult daughter with sickle cell disease.
The frustrations are very similar to what Cecil was talking about, the care at the ER. I mean, of course, it's frustrating when your daughter is hurting and there's nothing you can really do to help other than give maybe a heat pack. But the biggest frustration is going into the ER, and we do everything in our power not to have to go. Our daughter goes to the hematologist 3 times a week to get treatment, to stay hydrated, to give, you know, all these different protocols to make sure she doesn't go in the hospital. Because once she goes in, she's not allowed to have a transfusion. She had a transfusion that messed up her blood back when she was 19. And so now all they can really do for her is pain management.
Wow. Sometimes fathers feel that they really don't have a place in comforting or seeking treatment for their child, especially when the child is a stepchild. And yet, I know that the work you have done with your daughter, what can you say to those folks to help reassure them that they are very important, a very important piece of the family?
Well, for me, I don't make the distinction between stepchild and child. I've never, ever, I think the only time I ever said she's my stepdaughter is when a doctor comes into the hospital room and Marissa introduces me as her dad, and they give me this look like, how are you a Caucasian her father? And, you know, then I'll say I'm her stepdad, but I see what you are not doing and what needs to be done. You know, she's always at the exact same hospital, the exact same ER. And every time you go into the ER, it's like they've never seen her before in her life, never have a clue about what sickle cell is. And she might have been there even maybe 5 days earlier in the hospital for 2 weeks. Her charts are all there. Everything about her whole life is in the computer at this hospital. So why are you questioning what worked a week ago? This is the protocol. You can go back 5 years, 10 years. This is what works to bring the pain down. And after waiting 4 or 5 hours, as you said, without any medication, another hour could be the difference between 2 weeks in the hospital and 2 months. And that's, you asked about frustration. That's really it. And trying to convince these people that look at her, or the nurses, you know, there are some good ones, some that remember her. But for the most part, it's like fighting a battle. She needs something for her pain now, not 3 hours from now, not 4 hours. I go out to the nurse's station. Can you please call her doctor, her primary care doctor? He will authorize this. Please make the call. Please get her medicine, because the longer you wait, the longer she's going to be in here and the more money it's going to cost you, the insurance company, the state, whoever is paying whatever portion of the bill. It's just like, all you need to do is care for her. Follow the NIH guidelines. They're all right there. If you're not sure what to do, go to the government website. Look at it. That's all you have to do. And please don't give her 1-2 milligrams of morphine when you know in her whole chart, going back, if the beginning of the crisis, 10 milligrams will bring it under control. And then you'd like start to get it under control and then bring it down once you know. Like, you wouldn't take a half an aspirin if you had a headache. You would take the 2 tablets to bring your headache down. I'll take a half and, you know. That's the frustration. And I think that's the key word today.
Yep. But, you know, when you answered that question, I heard so much passion in your voice. I can tell that you are really a critical piece of this family and a critical piece of her care, because quite frankly, having a child, whether it is a small child or an adult child with sickle cell disease, is more than a full-time job, and it can wear away at you. And I believe that the father can provide that needed support to the patient as well as to the mother, because mm-hmm. then she knows that she's not fighting the battle alone. And I'm sure that that has made a huge difference in your family.
Well, thank you. I hope that I'm helping and not causing more stress. But, no. but there is a lot, you know, again, because of no transfusions, you have to go to the doctor 3 or 4 times a week to stay out of the hospital, because every time she would go in, there's another infection that comes along, or stuff you get at the hospital that can prolong it. And so really the goal is to stay out as long as you possibly can. So if we end up having to go to the ER, we've done anything and everything we can to avoid that.
We're speaking with Ron Shapiro, who is one of our board members of Access Advocacy. He generally fills in as our engineer on our podcast. But most importantly, as you can tell, he is the father of an adult with sickle cell disease and brings a new meaning to what it means to be a family. Thank you very much, Ron.
Well, thank you.
And we are Access Advocacy, and we're speaking to you with thepowerofvoices.com. We'll be right back. Okay, so we're back. This is Access Advocacy, coming to you on The Power of Voices. And Adrian, I went first, and I told you what my favorite show was. Give me some hints. What's your favorite show?
Well, I had this really great chat. Now that you've mentioned fathers, we're always talking about moms.
Right.
I had this great chat with Lakia Bailey's mom. Now, Dr. Bailey is head of the Sickle Cell Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And we interviewed her, and we were talking about how their organization, which is made up, what's so unique about it is that it's made up of people who actually have sickle cell disease or are caregivers of someone with sickle cell disease, and it's patients, it's parents, it's people who are fighting this disease in their own families, who decide to create community-based organizations, who've all come together under this consortium and have said, we want to take part in the research. We want to take part in policy. We want to look after ourselves. And it's, some people would say, oh, well, that makes sense. But when you think about how completely exhausted sickle cell can make you, or as a family member, you know, we talk about how the onion effect, where your support just peels away and peels away, that in a relatively short amount of time, this consortium has become very, very powerful. So we're interviewing Dr. Bailey, very, very impressive young woman. But her mom, her mom was in the office. So I said, put your mom on the phone. And what was so interesting about the mom, she voiced some of the same concerns that all of us moms do. But what she said was, in such an open and honest way, the kids kind of come here how they are. So sickle cell was not all that Lakia was,
mm-hmm.
and how it was such a battle for her to kind of let her be that person who she came into the world as. And I really liked that chat.
Yes.
I really did like that chat. I still don't know if that's my favorite yet.
But I can see why it would be, because Lakia is certainly someone special, and I remember her at the National Medical Association meeting, and she and some of her members from the consortium came over, and it was in a big ballroom at the convention center, and there was a panel of experts, you know, the people that we see at a lot of different conventions were there, and luckily they had some blankets with them because the room was cold. And so everybody else is sitting around like we do at conventions, and here are these 7 or 8 people with sickle cell disease all wrapped up in their blankets. But there was a question to the panel that they really didn't have a good answer for, and Dr. Lakia Bailey stood up and spoke for the sickle cell community, and she was very impressive, very moving. So that mom has done a lot right. She has absolutely done a lot right.
That she has.
So, Adrian, where do we go from here?
Well, I think that, you know, in thinking about what we've done, so we've done a lot of advocating and a lot of growing in this last year. Two of the patients that I was close to, we lost.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, you've heard me kind of really speak about, was due to really, really what I call inhumanity.
Yes.
And the other was our Trevor Thompson, mm-hmm. of Tennessee, who we lost, who was a force in the community,
mm-hmm.
had done all of these amazing things, had just completed his PhD, got really good care, and yet they both passed away from sepsis.
Yes.
I think for me, understanding that,
mm-hmm.
Here you had both spectrums. You mm-hmm. had someone who had been neglected.
Right.
And someone who was not really sophisticated and supported. And here you had someone completely on the other end,
mm-hmm.
who was supported by family and friends and community and had all this knowledge and knew how to advocate for himself and others, had this voice.
Right.
And I started to think, how does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's formed that this coming year, the 2017 to 2018, we have to really get involved in policy.
Yes, especially after what's happened over the last couple of weeks, where people have, in many ways, they have found their voice. But I want to make sure that our community understands the many ways what our government does actually supports the sickle cell community. Again, we think too often of, as Adrian was just saying, the people who die of sepsis because they haven't received good treatment, or the people who are just treated so disrespectful in the emergency room. But there are some government agencies that are struggling to maintain their financing. It doesn't have anything to do with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. It's just how the government does business. People know about the CDC. That's more like infectious diseases. But when people get infections in hospitals, which happens with sickle cell patients because their immune system is already compromised, the CDC can get involved.
Right. Generally, they have a CDC team member who is assigned to their case.
Right. 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 One of the other groups that has been immensely powerful for us is the NIH. NIH is the National Institutes of Health. And they developed and wrote the 100-plus page guidelines on the treatment of sickle cell disease. When we were in D.C. interacting with them, we as advocates were pointing out to them that this is great, we're so glad you did it, but now you have to get doctors to actually know what it says and use it. And unfortunately, the NIH research arm has lost about 20% of their funding. Again, this isn't something that goes through Congress in terms of the Affordable Care Act. It has to do with budget and influence. And if you are more concerned about how many battleships we have and how many F-14s and how many of that kind of thing, then somehow this funding for medical research gets lost in the shuffle. And I think we absolutely critically have to find our voices and not just respond. It's kind of easy to respond. I do it. People send me stuff on the internet, and yes, I click to sign whatever it is and add my name to the list of things I do or don't want. But we are not as aware as I believe we should be in how the government influences what happens to our community, whether it's federal government or whether it's the state government. And so in terms of where we go from here, I hope that we can have a few more of our government representatives to speak with us about the work they do, about what's happened to their budget, what they are able to do in the coming years, what's coming up. We've been talking about people that we met that work at the NIH, and I have a feeling that they would be willing to talk with us. I've met a couple of our state legislators, went to a conference in Sacramento a few weeks ago, the Family Voices Conference, and I was really impressed. These are people who have the best interest, not just of those people who have sickle cell disease, but people that have all kinds of rare diseases and chronic diseases. So I think that's one place that we need to really focus.
Absolutely. If we are going to make a difference,
yes,
that's, I think, has to take front and center.
Yeah.
Of what we're doing and who we're reaching out to and the things that we have to learn in the coming year.
Right. Well, again, and it's hard when you are a family who is dealing with a chronic illness. As you know, because I've told you in past shows, both of my grandchildren are special needs. My grandson with sickle cell disease and my granddaughter with autism. And they're doing okay, but their parents have their work cut out for them. They both work full-time jobs. Then there's the various meetings at school to make sure that the kids are in the right program and having their needs addressed. There's the meeting with people from the regional centers for the same thing to make sure that the resources that are out there are made available to the kids and that they're getting the right resources. So it's very hard for those families to also deal with government agencies. But Adrian, that's where you and I come in.
Right, right. And so that's kind of the second thing from this year that I think I've really come to understand that there are these gaps in our community. And as you mentioned, services. So where does a family go to get information about services that their loved one with sickle cell disease is entitled to? I hate to say entitled to, but maybe qualifies for.
Sure.
I think that is, again, the second part. I mean, I don't want to sound like a politician, but when they were talking about this whole thing of the stool or the support over which we stand for our organization,
right.
I think policy and I think providing services,
yes.
Such as where do you go for services?
Yes.
The hands-on advocacy, which can make a difference. We've
absolutely.
Learned between life and death, having someone there who knows. Education for the patients, education for the medical staff, education for the family, all of that as services. I think access advocacy, if we're going to be true to our name, needs to, in 2017-18, make that another priority.
I agree, and you were talking about a course that you took at UCLA about organ transplants, and you know that as much as you have learned over not only the last couple of years as we've worked together, but all of the years that you worked with your daughter, and as much as we have heard about bone marrow transplants in sickle cell, but there was a whole bunch of stuff that we didn't know anything about. What did you find out?
Well, some of it, you know, is that, you know, after you have a transplant, you are on a life of medication. Now, it's one of the reasons that people have problems from a transplant is that their body has a foreign matter, and the body goes, which is pretty
right.
efficient, but it's a closed system, says, oh, no, there's something foreign here. And the white cells, of course, go kind of nuts and attack it. So once you have a transplant like that, then you are on meds all your life to keep your body from rejecting whatever right. that foreign matter right. is. And so you kind of know that and kind of know vaguely that these people are going to be on meds. But you don't know things like that weakens their immune system. So they're very, very susceptible to infections, both bacterial and fungal. So that means no cat, because you can't be around cat poo. Poo becomes very important.
Yes.
So cat poo, bird poo, dog poo, turtle poo.
So I guess it's stuffed animals from here on in.
I think so. Things like what you can eat, because it affects various medications, whether or not your body absorbs it. So we all know that, you know, for me, my parents who took high blood pressure medicine mm-hmm. couldn't drink grapefruit
right.
juice or have a grapefruit. I had no idea that pomegranate, which yeah. is being, you're told, you know, you should have pomegranate. That interferes with meds. The whole idea of you're supposed to have deep greens. Well, maybe, mm-hmm. but that's a lot of vitamin K. Mm-hmm. And so that interferes with things. So you're going to, your kale, all these things that you would think would be healthy. There is so much to learn up front so that you can, I don't know if it's make an informed decision, but more of not be caught by surprise.
Right, right. Well, when you talked about the 10, 12, 14 pills a day
for life,
and that if you miss one or two of them, you can put yourself in jeopardy.
Right.
I didn't have a clue. I mean, I just really didn't have a clue, because what happens is that people say, oh, this person got a bone marrow transplant. We've even met them at various conferences. Oh, yes, I got the bone marrow transplant. I'm feeling so much better now. I don't have the sickle cell crisis, you know, all of that stuff. Great. But then they don't say anything about the 10 or 12 or 14 pills a day that they have to take. And after a while, that gets tiring. It yeah. just gets tiring. So I think that's as part of where we go from here, is we know that every family in our community can't get to all these things. It would be impossible. And there's basically just the two of us, but we've got some good helpers, people who post things on Facebook for us, our friend John Spencer, who does our website. These are folks that can help us get the word out to you. And we're going to do our best to, as we go to these conferences, put whatever information we get from the conferences on the website, talk about it, get some of the people to come on the podcast with us so that we can really fulfill one of the goals that we've stated when we founded the group, which was the goal for education, because it's absolutely critical. So education in terms of the disease, education in terms of government agencies and how things work. So that's going to be one of the things that you should be seeing from us in the next year.
Yeah, I think our continued participation in and support for and our value of research.
Right.
And again, as you said, that in an educational front, that would be in supporting trials, that would be in support of new technologies, in particular treatments. Right. And, of course, you hear me talk constantly about stem cells, because that's like changing
yes.
daily. They are learning more and more. And since it's an interesting thing, you start off thinking that your journey is going to be one thing. And then you sort of hop into it and you get busy and it gets refined.
Yes.
It does get refined. And I guess that means that we're on the right track.
I think so. It's refined, it's growing, it's branching off in some directions that we weren't even aware of until we started. But I think it's good, and I think it's what needs to happen. What is coming to us is what needs to come in order for us to really begin to make a difference in our community.
Okay, so now I'm thinking more and more about another one of my favorite talks.
Uh-oh.
And that was with Randy, who was the head of CIRM.
Oh, yes.
We had the great honor. I mean, this guy is really, really busy.
Yes.
And we had a chance to really talk to him. And the thing about my discussion with him had to do with the fact that he has this, so it's the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and they do stem cell research. California's given them a mandate and several billion dollars to look for cures for diseases that do not have treatments and cures. And they have set up this amazing network between universities and private industry up mm-hmm. and down the coast of California that actually has a global reach. It's not just the California, but California is sort of the backbone of it. But what was so fascinating about that talk was that here was this guy who had all of this money, all of this exposure to all of the best brains in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? It's kind of the center of it. And he is a true believer that it's all about the patient. I mean, for me, I think that that was really, you hear people kind of give service, mouth service to, yes, I want to help, and yes, that's our goal. But he really is truly, truly all about the patient. And what that does is, for me as the mother of a child with sickle cell and the mother of another child who's a trait carrier and who do not want to pass this gene on, have her pass this gene on, or if she does, the risk of having a child with the disease. To have someone in that key position say that every day, with every decision that he makes, it is with putting us, those of us living with genetic diseases, first, that ray of true hope that's backed by action and finances and brains. For me, I think I'm thinking maybe that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Adrian, I'm so glad that you came up with this idea of reviewing where we've been, who we've spoken to. It's given us an opportunity to talk a little bit about where we're going in the future. As soon as we get our next set of shows lined up, we're going to put them on our website and on our Facebook page so that people will have a chance to check out what it is that we've been talking about and where we're going from here. This is Access Advocacy. We're coming to you on the Power of Voices. You can find us on our website, www.axisadvocacy.org. We'll be right back.
We're just about out of time, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, axisadvocacy.org, or the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's axisadvocacy.org.
And please join us again next Tuesday on the powerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all of our programs there. I'm Nancy Renee.
I'm Adrian Shapiro. Thank you for listening.
Pushing, keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing.